year 00-1751, Worldwide for Aesthetic Supply, Inc. versus Robert J. Mikulski et al. We will first hear from Attorney Donald L. Rumenson of Godfrey & Kahn, and then we'll hear from Mr. Gerbers. Mr. Rumenson.
May it please the court, we represent the petitioners in this matter, Robert and Kara Mikulski, doing business as Enterprise Machine, and Voyager Incorporated, who I'll collectively refer to as Voyager. The issue in this case is whether evidence that a defendant manufactures a defective product is admissible to prove damages in a misappropriation of trade secrets claim under Wisconsin Statutes 134.90 sub 4. Our position is that evidence must relate to the cause of action or the causes of action before the court. This is what the trial court held in this case from day one. There were from the start of this case, even before the trial began, there was a constant back and forth over whether evidence of a manufacturing of a defective product could go toward damages in a misappropriation of trade secrets claim. The trial court concluded that the only evidence that was going to be admissible was evidence that related to a cause of action that survived summary judgment. And that the plaintiff was entitled to actual damages that were directly related to a misappropriation of a trade secret, but that in this case, the plaintiff was also asking for something more. In other words, the plaintiff was asking for something that happened after the alleged misappropriation, and that if actionable, was not actionable under 134.90. In essence, if actionable, was actionable under other laws, which went to the causes of action that the plaintiff was actually alleging, which in this case were confusion of source and what is called commercial disparagement. If you look at what the plaintiff himself and his so-called expert witness testified to, primarily they said that what happened was that the industry or their customers were confusing the product that our client made with the product they made, and also that they would not buy aluminum prosthetic components anymore because the product that our client made harmed the reputation of aluminum and thereby the reputation of Worldwide, causing them damage.
Can I ask, just in 134.92, you talked about misappropriation. It talks about disclosing and using. And it seemed to me, and I know that your opponent argues that the reason this would fall under that, this type of consequential damage, because there was the use of the product. In other words, the using category of misappropriation. And that's their argument. How do you distinguish that? Because there was use, your client was using the product, and it was so-called defective product, which affected their sales. That's what they're saying. But
right.
The use.
There's several reasons that essentially begs the question. The statute says misappropriate or use the trade secret. First, we have to ask, what is the trade secret in this case? And the plaintiff is a little unclear on what is the trade secret. At one point, I think it's footnote 2 on page 10 of their brief, they say this: the trade secrets are the color, the material, and the design of this product. But what our clients have done is not actually use the trade secret. They, according to the Worldwide, they've done something else, which is create a defective product. In other words, they're using something else. And so it's our position that our client is not using a trade secret. They've done something other than that. They've manufactured a defective product.
I was having trouble understanding, because for a while there was this commercial relationship between yourselves and you asked, well, they asked you to manufacture this prosthetic, which was made of aircraft aluminum and had a certain color. And that was the trade, that was allegedly the trade secret, that product was. Then there was the termination of the relationship. They continued to use that product because, although defective, so how, fitting into that context, that's what I was having trouble understanding.
It's a little unclear what the plaintiff is alleging is the trade secret. As I understand the evidence, and there's a conflict in the evidence over, or a dispute in the evidence over whether this product was created by Worldwide, or whether it was a joint venture, or whether Enterprise Machine created it. It's not the typical situation where a person comes into a machine shop and says, here's the blueprints and the specifications, simply manufacture this. As I understand the evidence, they went, in fact, as I understand the evidence, Worldwide went with a competitor's endoskeletal components and said, make something like this. And there were some, I'd call them minor variations. Our client then manufactured it and in his testimony, created this thing. Now, in about 1998, the plaintiff alleges that some of these products were returned allegedly defective. At that point, he went to our client and said, you have to change this. And our client allegedly said, this is caused by abuse by the end user. We don't think we need to change it. At that point, our client also says that Worldwide was engaging in other enterprises which or by which they weren't paying their bill anymore. For one reason or another, the relationship ended. Our client continued to create or manufacture the same product they were manufacturing. As my understanding, Worldwide had someone else manufacture something different, which, and so when you say that, or when they say that they're using the trade secret, if it's the color or the material, that's obvious. You know, we couldn't have defectively manufactured that. If it's the design, which design is it? Is it the design that we cooperatively manufactured? It's a design that our client says that he created, or is it this new design? So I think our point is that the statute says using or misappropriating a trade secret. What the trial court concluded, and we believe is correct, is that there are damages that a plaintiff can get for misappropriating or using a trade secret. But if you do something else, like create a defective product, you are, and under their allegations, you are actually alleging a different cause of action. In this case, it's a cause of action under the Federal Lanham Act for confusion of source. What they're saying is, you're creating this product, and people out there think it's our product. So they're not buying our product because it's defective. But that's really a confusion of source allegation. And so what the trial court was saying is that that was not pled. I'm going to restrict the evidence in this case to what was pled and what survived summary judgment. And our argument is, if the court judicially construes 134.90 to allow the same damages that one could get in a different cause of action that wasn't pled, then you allow the plaintiff to short-circuit the requirements of those other laws, the federal laws. You also potentially get into a preemption problem.
Can you bring a Lanham cause of action in state court?
Well, Wisconsin doesn't have the equivalent of a Lanham Act.
That,
I think you could bring it in state court.
Could you allege a violation of 15 U.S.C. section, whatever it is, in state court? Could it have been a 1125? Could it have been a cause of action?
I believe the plaintiff could have alleged 1125 in the state court action, and I think in their brief they've conceded that. That they've said that this argument, they said admittedly this these circumstances amount to what could have been pled as a Lanham Act case.
Don't you think that would have been dismissed on summary judgment, though? There is no factual support for a Lanham Act claim here because there was no effort by your client to pass this off as the plaintiff's product, either by making representations that it was or by labeling it in a similar way as if to pass it off. My understanding of the facts is that your client labeled product, what small amount was sold after the contract was terminated, as its own, not as that of the plaintiff, right?
That's correct. They made it as their own, but I think what the plaintiff is alleging is that you'd have to look carefully at it to see that it wasn't theirs, and so when customers saw this at first glance, they thought it was a worldwide product. I would hope that at least the confusion of source allegation would be dismissed on summary judgment. Now, the commercial disparagement, which is actually doing something that harms their commercial reputation, I don't know whether that would survive summary judgment or not, but still, the point is that they didn't plead it. And by not pleading it, that was never brought to the trial courts. It was never an issue before the trial court. So what the trial court said is that of the various things that were pleaded, breach of contract, for instance, was dismissed. And there was all this hullabaloo about what evidence could come in through these witnesses to prove damages in the trade secret case. And the trial court was saying, I'm limiting this evidence to the causes of action before the court. And that makes sense. It makes sense because under 13490, you have to judicially construe that statute to encompass what other laws already encompass, and which the Wisconsin legislature did not see fit to put, at least in our opinion, did not see fit to put in 13490. Wisconsin doesn't have the equivalent of the Lanham Act. There's also other requirements that the plaintiff has conceded they could have done to protect their rights. They could have, there's patent laws available, copyright, trademark. There's none of these things were attempted in this case. In fact, another one of our arguments is that to judicially construe 13490 to encompass these other causes of action, the same damages that you could get in other causes of action, would be contrary to public policy. It would create disincentives in a commercial context for public policy considerations. Public policy, the law of public policy has always said that we encourage competition, we encourage innovation through competition. We've raised the Head Start rule in our briefs, which says essentially that a plaintiff is entitled only to damages during that period in which they have a head start or a competitive advantage. But once the defendant can figure this thing out, they no longer get damages, they're cut off. That encourages...
Mr. Wilmanson, let me interrupt you if I might for a minute. When I start thinking about this case and start trying to analyze whether or not the trial judge was right, I start with the statute. This was brought under the Uniform Trade Secrets Act. The Trade Secrets Act talks about actual loss, being able to recover for actual loss. The case law, at least the case law from the Seventh Circuit, talks about the ability to recover consequential damages. Aren't those terms broad enough to cover the kind of damages that plaintiff was seeking here?
Well, I guess the short answer is they could be, but I think the court has to be very careful in taking that leap because, for instance, Judge Posner in this microdata case is the only court I'm aware of that says that. There's no authority cited for it. It's dicta. Judge Posner is one of these guys who is in a small circle that is on one side of the trade secret argument, the debate. There are other camps that are opposed to that.
Well, in the microdata case, Judge Posner, who wrote that opinion, actually uses an example that's very similar to the claim of the plaintiff in right. this case. It says that, look, this is a tort. You ought to be able to recover consequential damages. What's wrong with his reasoning?
Well, what's wrong with his reasoning is, first, it's unsupported by case law. You know, that's number one. The trade secrets law has been around since about 1865 in common law fashion. This Uniform Trade Secrets Act is a relatively new promulgation that a lot of states have, but this has been around for 150 years. I have done a lot of research. There are thousands of cases all over the country on trade secrets law. I have never found another case. I have not found one single case that allows what the plaintiff wants in this case. Now, if it were as simple as to say that a jury should decide whether these are consequential damages, it seems to me some courts in the last 150 years in these thousands of cases would have come to that conclusion, and Judge Posner would have been able to cite some authority.
Did any of those cases ask for these kind of damages, and the court said no?
I've never seen one that did, but I think if it were so simple, certainly someone would have. I mean, that's what I read out of it. And of over 150 years, no one has ever asked for these types of damages.
We've got to start somewhere. That's the question.
I don't think this is a good case to start with.
Prospective only.
Mr. Ralph?
Let me just... It's hard to put this case, for me, in a perspective. For purposes of this case only, it hasn't been tried, neither the judge nor jury has made decisions on the trade secret. For purposes of this case only, do we have to assume that there has been an allegation of a trade secret? And for the purposes of damages, we have to assume there is a trade secret, just for the purposes of damages, just to decide this issue.
I think for the issue that's before the court, I think it would be proper to assume there's a trade secret, although that's heavily disputed, of course.
Right. I understand that. So that there is a trade secret. And we have to assume, for just this purpose of this case now, in this decision, we have to assume that your client used this trade secret and that it was defectively used.
Well, I think that gets back to the question of what is the trade secret?
Okay. But, I mean, just to decide whether these damages would be permissible, it seems to me you have to assume that you're going to be able to ultimately, the plaintiff is ultimately going to be able to prove there is a trade secret and it was used by your client and it was used effectively. Otherwise, we don't have a damage issue.
Right. And we don't have a problem with a plaintiff acquiring damages for the use of a trade secret.
I understand.
Right.
Okay. And that we're only talking about, and that it was used effectively, and that as a result of this defective use, they are trying to show, and the question is, can they show as a result of this defective use of the product, can they show that customers were misled, or customers thought that it was the plaintiff's product, and therefore customers stopped buying or reduced buying the plaintiff's products? That's what this case is about. I mean, is that the essence boiled down? So then we say, yes, you can bring in this evidence and get damages, or no, you cannot.
Perhaps a more precise way to say it would be that the plaintiffs are entitled to damages that are directly caused by the use or the misappropriation of a trade secret, but when they allege something else, that, for instance, their reputation is harmed by the manufacture of a defective product, then they are infringing on another cause of action, and that cause of action should be pled, because then otherwise, if the same damages apply to a trade secret case that apply to another cause of action that wasn't pled, you get into a whole series of complications and problems, and that's why I don't think this is a good case to start for the court to say that these damages are allowable.
But I think what the Chief is getting at, Mr. Robinson, is that we could assume for purposes of deciding this case that this was a theft of the trade secret and that the prosthetic devices were defective. And what you are saying is, it doesn't matter whether they were defective or not, you can't recover damages for that defective product, for use of that defective product.
I think that
it's not an allowable item of damage.
Not under what they pled as far as the defective product element goes. They could still get damages for using a trade secret.
Right.
But if they're alleging that because of the manufacture of a defective product, their reputation is harmed, or their customers confuse our product with theirs, and therefore don't buy their product, or that they don't buy aluminum because the ones that we manufactured allegedly defective cracked or the set screws slipped, that's a different cause of action. So it's actually a
combined. Right. I understand that's your position, but it seems to me that the issue in this case is whether or not the use of a defective product under these circumstances is actionable under the Uniform Trade Secrets Act, whether you can recover damages under the Uniform Trade Secrets Act.
That's essentially the issue.
Yeah.
Maybe you could say, in addition to what you could normally recover for using or misappropriating a trade secret. See, the thing is, this trade secret, as I understand it, what their complaint was and why they say it was defective is because there were some set screws. These are essentially tubes and connectors inside a prosthetic lower leg, as I understand it. There's some set screws and some holes, and they were complaining that these set screws drifted. In other words, when they tightened them up, they would drift, and the holes weren't drilled precisely and things like that. Those are defects.
To me, that's irrelevant for the purposes of this appeal. And maybe I'm wrong, but what's the only relevant question, seems to me, is what is assuming all of this, is it allowable as damages under the term actual loss of the Uniform Trade Secret?
Right. I guess my point was that this drifting of set screws or the misalignment of the holes is not the trade secret. You know, the trade secret is a properly manufactured product, and if they want damages for that are caused by a defective product and which result in harm to their reputation or confusion of source, then they should plead that. Because if they don't, then there's a whole host of problems you encounter. And why should a plaintiff be better off when they haven't pled something? I mean, the irony of this case is that the plaintiff is better off by not getting a patent, by not being precise in their pleadings, by not promoting competition and these other public policy considerations, by not even having contracts, which in a commercial setting, the court has always said, commercial entities have to establish their rights and obligations by contract. The plaintiff is actually better off by not doing any of those things, just filing a trade secret claim and saying, well, you've created a defective product. We did nothing to protect our rights, but we're just going to allege a violation of a trade secret, and we're going to collect everything that we would have collected anyway. So that doesn't promote any of the public policy considerations behind patent, copyright, trademark law, contract law, being precise in your pleadings, pleading. I mean, it's kind of essentially the same as pleading breach of contract, having it dismissed, and then during trial introducing a whole bunch of evidence on breach of contract anyway.
Of course, your opponent is saying we didn't have to plead it that precisely because it is an actual loss. It seems to me that you've got to direct your argument to that this is not an actual loss under the statute. To me, this is it's very difficult, but nevertheless, a basic statutory interpretation.
I understand. The argument could be, when you read the Court of Appeals decision or the Seventh Circuit decision in Microdata, it appears very simple. This is simply a matter of letting a jury decide what is foreseeable and what's the consequence of the use of this product. I guess our counter to that, and what we feel strongly about, is it is tempting, especially in a moral setting where there's a misappropriation, to say this is a very simple case. Let's just let a jury decide whether this is consequential. The problem is you encroach upon and you infringe upon all these other areas. And why do that when all you have to say is that they should be responsible for pleading if that's what they want to plead? And there are these other laws out there. See, it's not even necessary to say that this is a consequence, because what they want is already available through other laws. They could have pled Lanham Act. They could have gotten a patent. They could have had a contract which precisely delineated the rights and obligations of various parties. And they didn't do any of that stuff. So all these other remedies are available, and yet they want this court to say, well, this is just a simple matter of consequential damages, even though there's not a single case for 150 years that says that. want this court to pronounce this.
When the Uniform Trade Secrets Act was passed, is there any evidence that the intent of the writers of the act was to narrow the scope of damages from former law on trade secrets?
I think there are several indications, in fact, more than indications, demonstrations in the law of limitations on the Trade Secrets Act. The biggest one is the Head Start rule. If it was simply a matter of consequential damages, there wouldn't be a Head Start rule, which says it's anti-competitive to prohibit the use of something after the initial competitive advantage, or Head Start is over.
Is that in the Act?
That is a rule that has come from the Act. I don't think there's any evidence that I'm aware of in the Act itself, just like there's no evidence in 13490, one way or the other. But case law has, as I understand it, case law has enacted this Head Start rule. They've also, case law
What I'm trying to get at, the Uniform Act has a very elaborate history, and there must have been various objectives for drafting the Uniform Trade Secrets Act. Do you have any evidence that one of those objectives was to narrow the scope of damages or narrow consequential damages beyond what was the prior law?
I think the answer to that is several. First of all, under the Uniform Act and the Wisconsin statute, damages are normally limited by the statute itself to lost profits or unjust enrichment, or if that can't be proved, to royalties. That in itself is a limitation. Beyond that, I'm not certain that the Act talks about it one way or another, but the Act is precise. It says actual damages, it says lost profits or unjust enrichment, or if you can't prove that, reasonable royalties. And what typically is the case is you have a contract between commercial parties that say we get X amount as a royalty on each sale, or XYZ. But the point is that I think the legislature took pains to limit damages in the Act to lost profits or unjust enrichment or royalties. But beyond that, there's a Head Start rule. And there's also a rule that you can reverse engineer these products. So if this was simply a matter of consequential damages, what would be the purpose of allowing a competitor to take a product, buy a product, and figure it out and then sell it? And there's no damages from that point on. And that's basically what the Head Start rule says. If you can reverse engineer this product, then it's anti-competitive to prohibit somebody from using that from that point forward, because we want to encourage competition. We want to encourage innovation of products. And the way you do that is not by saying a plaintiff has unlimited damages under causes of action they haven't even pled. And the way you do that is by encouraging them to take action that makes them responsible. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Williamson. Attorney, you will have 5 minutes in rebuttal, sir. Attorney Terry J. Gerber is representing Worldwide Prosthetic Supply. Mr. Gerber.
Good morning, members of the court. As Chief Justice Abrahamson has indicated, my name is Terry Gerber. I represent Worldwide Prosthetic Supply, Inc. Worldwide has always contended that the evidence of Voyager's marketing of these defective products, which incorporates Worldwide's trade secrets, as to its admissibility in an action for damages under Wisconsin Statute 134.90(4), as is Justice Balich has indicated, simply an issue of statutory construction. We believe that under the clear and unequivocal language of that particular statute, that Worldwide is entitled to present such evidence for its damages. Voyager tries to draw a distinction between the term misappropriation and misuse. In other words, the difference between misappropriating and using the trade secret. However, the plain language of the statute defines misappropriation as the using of the trade secret with without the express or implied consent of the owner of that particular trade secret. The plain language of the statute prohibits the using of that trade secret. Nowhere in that statute is there any limitation as to the successful or unsuccessful use of the trade secret. And that's important because, as counsel has indicated, there are many cases out there dealing with trade secret law, but most of them are a successful copying of a product for financial gain by the individual who has misappropriated the trade secret. That's not the case that we have here, and it's a case that is more akin to that which was discussed in the micro database case, or data systems case. What we have here is a situation where someone uses the trade secret, uses it in a defective manner, trying to make financial gain, but does so erroneously. So it's understandable that that would be an unusual type of case, and it's understandable that there'd be few reported cases about that. Next, Voyager suggests that the Court of Appeals decision permits Worldwide's recovery of an unlimited amount of damages. Again, the plain language of the statute provides that damages may include the actual loss caused by the violation, that being the misuse, and the unjust enrichment caused by the violation, which is not included in the actual loss. There isn't anything here that says that there's unlimited damages. Worldwide is only entitled to recover the amount of damages which is equal to their actual loss. Now, in their brief, Voyager states at page 13, and I quote, "Damages are obviously the loss of profits the owner would have been able to obtain but for the misappropriation." Notwithstanding their acknowledging that, Voyager contends that there is some other way of calculating damages other than proving the actual loss. First, Voyager cites to the case of Sokol at page 14 of its brief to suggest that the Voyager's sales should be the actual measure of damages because this is the extent of the unjust enrichment. In other words, what were the plaintiff's profits in this case? What were Worldwide's profits in the event it had sold the products that Voyager did? However, we must note that that's not the extent of the plaintiff's damages in this case. Worldwide claims to have experienced a substantial decline because of the product failure, because of the loss of confidence in the product that it had marketed.
How much product was sold while the parties were still under contract?
While the parties were under contract, I know that the year, I think it was the year of the sale, was about $600,000 worth of sales of product. Okay. I couldn't quote to you, Justice Sykes, exactly how many, what the dollar amount is, but by way of comparison, it was only $2,000 of product sale, although they were sold at a significantly lower cost.
Well, that's why I asked the question. Voyager, excuse me, sold approximately $1,900 worth of product after the contract was terminated.
Right.
And you're telling me that there were $600,000 worth of profit of product sold during the contract period, and those products were similarly defective. Is that right?
What had happened is that initially the products were fine. Then over time, there started to begin some sloppy manufacturing, for lack of a better term. And in the course of that, the screws began to drift. And Worldwide was advised by its suppliers, or by its distributors, excuse me, that we're starting to have some problems with these, get it corrected. We have to remember the market we're dealing with here. We are dealing with something that is a very limited market. We're dealing with something that's very important. We have very few manufacturers of this product worldwide.
Just so I would understand, and this is continued with the Sykes question. So if there was $600,000, and your testimony, as I understand it, was that there was a, say, 15% decline, you lost two customers, so you would be, this is the evidence you'd like to put before the jury, that these $1,900 worth of sales affected those $600,000 worth of sales. Is that correct?
Absolutely.
Yeah, that's what you're talking about.
Yes.
That's why you feel that from a consequential standpoint, that it was a consequence of these so-called defective products out there that lowered your ultimate sales of properly manufactured products.
Exactly. And that's what we get to the issue of commercial disparagement and the issues of whether or not a claim could have been brought under the Lanham Act. And certainly maybe looking at the very facts as alleged, maybe a claim could have been brought under the Lanham Act. But looking at that more closely, as Justice Sykes has indicated, we don't have an intent here. As the trial had presumed and went forward, we don't see any attempt here to disparage Worldwide. We don't see any attempt by Voyager to injure our client's sales, only to improve their own sales. And it is not the fact that there's been an injury to us as a company. It is the product. It is the product's failure. We are talking about...
Mr. Gerbers, yes, I was trying to think about this case and look at your side of it. One of the things that came to mind was the economic loss doctrine. And I was thinking about that in terms of the fact that you're dealing with a contract situation. You're dealing with a defective product. If the economic loss doctrine comes into play, then generally you're limited to contractual damages. You wouldn't be able to get into the tort type of damages that Judge Posner was talking about. Why shouldn't that approach be taken? Why shouldn't the court look at this as an economic loss doctrine type of situation?
Well, Justice Crooks, I think that the reason that we don't is simply because the economic loss doctrine, we have an issue here as to whether or not the extent that the parties' contractual arrangements, those contractual arrangements have been disputed in this case. And I think that in order for us to somehow make the uniform trade secret law, the economic loss doctrine, as well as contract law, all kind of work together, we must construct those that, so in a manner that they are harmonious with one another. And to do so, I think we have to look at the express language of the statute. And to the extent that actual damage can be proven, that's what we need to establish. And the court, the trial court has indicated, although I think that there may be an issue about that, but the trial court indicated initially that there was no breach of contract. So as a result, there could be no damages awarded under the economic loss doctrine if there's been no breach of contract. So I think what we're looking at here, Justice Crooks, is a separate tort, you know, a separate action above and beyond the contract. It's after the contract had terminated that the tortious conduct of Voyager had begun.
So in other words, you would focus on the statute and say that the using of the trade secret produces a tort type of action rather than a contract type of action?
Exactly. It arose after the contractual relationship of the parties.
The extent of the use that you're alleging of the trade secret is the $1,900 in sales post-contract, right?
That's what they have indicated as far as evidence of sales, yet they've testified that there were thousands of them manufactured and sold.
How much is it per unit?
There was a substantial deviation, Judge. I think like one-third or maybe even one-quarter of the cost. That was the difference between what Worldwide was selling the product for versus what Voyager was. Yeah, each unit is different. I couldn't recall exactly what they were, but there's a sizable difference.
Counsel, I just want clarification on that. Is it your position that the record indicates that the sales of Voyager was in the amount of $1,900 post termination of their relationship, and that there is testimony in the record that $1,900 equaled production and sale of thousands of these units?
That's what the defendant's testimony was. That was what Mr. Mikulski's testimony was. So it's difficult to try to correlate those two. I find that difficult to believe that he was selling these at an average of $2,000 or $2 apart, but that's what his testimony was. But the bottom line is that in the market that we're working with, it is essential that these products be removed from the market. As indicated, Worldwide destroyed its product and obviously put out notices to those that their distributors who had handled the product. Unfortunately, they can't get them all. The Mikulskis marketed these products over the internet, and we can't have failure of this type of product when they're permitting people to walk around on the street so they can get along like most of us can. And one thing...
Could I ask a question? You said you didn't think you had a claim under the Lanham Act, but let's just hypothetically, if you thought you had a claim under the Lanham Act, could you bring it in state court? And could you bring it in state court now when you're going back to trial?
Truthfully, I have not researched that issue, but my initial inclination would be that I suspect that the state court would have concurrent jurisdiction over a federal law issue in this type of case. However, obviously we've gone past the stage for pleadings and so forth. I doubt that that claim could be brought anymore unless the court would grant the leave to amend the pleadings. But, Justice Prosser, the reason I don't think that that is a viable claim in this particular instance is because, once again, we're not talking about someone trying to pass off their product as ours. What we're really talking about is similar to that identified in the Dharma case, and that is simply what we have here is a product failure. It is a failure of the product. As Mr. Kingsley testified, the belief in the industry is that these aluminum products, these high-tech aluminum products that were designed by Worldwide and molded down to a smaller design will fail in the marketplace. They will fail on customers. They will fail on patients, and that could cause injury. And again, it's important to look at the market we're dealing with. We're not talking about widgets or screws or things that we might have mass-produced in a machine company. We're talking about the way people are ambulating.
Oh, Mr. Gerbers, I want to get into the statutory interpretation. I presume you're relying on the words of the statute, the actual loss caused by the violation.
Correct.
And the violation, I take it, is the misappropriation.
Correct.
There is no violation for defective manufacture, right? There has to be a misappropriation in order for there to be any damages at all.
Well, Justice Ballage, that I would respectfully disagree with you on, because I think that the statute identifies misappropriation as using the trade secrets of another. No matter how that use may occur, whether they use it in a perfectly acceptable condition or they use it in a defective condition, regardless of which way they use it, my client is entitled to their actual loss.
Well, it seems to me, anyway, that the argument can be made that the statute reads actual loss caused by the misappropriation. Have you done a word search, by the way, in the statutes to see if there's a distinction made by the legislature between consequential loss and actual loss?
No, I am not.
Okay.
No, I am not.
I'll do that. So, in any event, if you could face this argument, an actual loss caused by the misappropriation is the actual theft of the product, of the trade secret. And that, in fact, this loss is not the loss that you're suffering from the misappropriation is different from the loss that you are suffering from the misappropriation followed by the putting in a defective product into the marketplace.
Once again, I think that the misappropriation is defined in the statute as using. So I don't see these as two separate acts, as Voyager does. I see their using as constituting the misappropriation. That's the way I perceive this.
But what about what happens if you prevail here? I would assume then that every trade secret, or at least a great deal of trade secret cases, are going to ask for damages not just for the misappropriation, but are going to allege some kind of a defective product being placed in the marketplace, thereby causing greater damages.
Well, I think in order to do that, Justice, it would be required that there has to be some evidence to show that it was, in fact, defective. Again, we've had a substantial amount of history of successful misappropriation. And that's the way I expect that it's going to continue to do it. If not, someone's either trying to tortiously interfere or to disparage, as counsel has indicated, but that's only to the extent they do it on purpose. Here we have an accidental action which has created a defective product causing damages to our client. One thing that I really want to focus on, however, are the issues of the Soco case and Forest Laboratories case that are relied upon, which indicates that basically that we should be looking at this head start rule or some other type of measure of damages, such as the reasonable royalty method of damages. However, the statute has a pecking order. It says actual loss. That is the first thing we need to establish. And then we can also get unjust enrichment to the extent it's not included in actual loss. And finally, reasonable royalties can be awarded if there is no other means by which damages may be awarded. This head start rule is troubling to me because the Sokol case talks about the head start rule being applied only where the misappropriation gives the defendant, or in this case Voyager, a head start in manufacturing the product and marketing its product. And as identified in the Sokol case, in fact, in that particular case, the court concluded that the jury very well may have believed that without the misappropriation, there wouldn't have been any head start. That defendant would never have manufactured the product. And I think that's the same case we have here. In Soco, the court said we don't apply the head start rule here because the jury could have concluded they never would have manufactured the product at all. Here we have an individual that was presented with prosthetic components and no idea what they were, has no education, no experience in the field, no training, didn't even identify them correctly at the time of trial. Didn't know the difference between an endoskeletal component and a skeletal component, that being, of course, the bones in our body. He referred to them as skeletal components. Nothing about the industry, nothing about the market. Therefore, we do not believe the head start rule would be applicable. With respect to the issue of a patent, and the defense relies upon the Comco case, the Comco case, however, indicates that we cannot, the state cannot prohibit the copying of information that is in the public domain. The Comco case, the Sears Roebuck case, and the, for the other one here, the Benigno cases, all involve state laws which were created to protect a device or product which was either unpatented or where the patent had expired, but the information was available and it was in the public domain. The Bonino case sticks out most in my mind because that particular case, they passed basically a self-protection measure for one company saying that no one else can manufacture this type of boat hull. And the court said, you can't do that. It's out there. It's open. But that has... trade secret. Trade secret law is even indicated by the defense in its brief, in Voyager's brief, and verified and confirmed by the microdatabase case. What we have here is someone trying to benefit from their secret, something that is not known to generally everyone in the industry. And Mr. Kingsley testified. People didn't know the type of aluminum that was used to manufacture the product, the iodizing procedure that was used to create the color, or the lightweight mechanisms that were used, the changes made in the marketplace to make this a better product. Therefore, we have to make the distinction between the patent law and the uniform trade secret law. If we were to accept Voyager's argument, we wouldn't have any need for the uniform trade secret law. Everything would have to be patented or it would automatically be in the public's domain. That's precisely what the uniform trade secret was created to curtail. Furthermore, obviously there's certain issues with respect to getting a patent. You must have sufficient uniqueness. There must be different things done in the process to make it a better product. I don't know as though the Worldwide could have established a patent on this product. But again, all we're seeking here is to protect its secret. Finally, Voyager says that even if the evidence of Voyager's marketing of these defective products would otherwise be admissible under 134.90, that the trial court's conclusion that any such relevance was substantially outweighed by its prejudicial effect should still be upheld and should be the decision of this court. However, we need to look at that in the light in which it was stated. It is based upon the trial court's conclusion that such evidence was not admissible to prove damages. The Court of Appeals, based upon the microbase data case and other other cases that are before us, indicates that it is the actual loss to which our client is entitled to. Therefore, it is relevant. Therefore, if it's relevant to establish that particular issue, then the trial court, I'm sure, would change its position as to the probative value of that evidence. Furthermore, it's necessary. It's necessary for the worldwide to prove or to establish this evidence and to present it to the jury so that it is able to establish its actual loss that was caused by Voyage's use of the trade secrets. And for those reasons, such evidence should be admissible. The last thing I'd like to get back to for just a moment is this confusion of source, because I think it's important to look at the microdata case, because that particular case says, and of course it is dicta as indicated by Mr. Romanson, but what the case involved was soured relationships caused as a result of the actions of one of the parties. And the court concluded that that is a consequence for which the plaintiff in that case could recover damages, because it was something that they knew as a result of their actions could cause additional damages to Dharma in that case. And the court went on to say it's as if a bug was put into the computer, into the software, and they blamed the plaintiff for that particular, the defendant in that case, since it was a counterclaim, blamed Dharma for that particular action. And in that case, that's very similar to what we have here. We have a situation where we have a product, and that product continues to be manufactured in a defective condition. The trade secrets were used by Voyager and marketed to the general public. This isn't a situation where we have harm to the reputation of Worldwide as a business. It's not a confusion of source issue in the sense that we can't tell the difference, because as Justice Sykes has indicated, wouldn't our damages then have stopped once the products were marketed? But they didn't. We have a failure of the product. Just like you would.
The failure of the product, though, occurred long before the misappropriation. The defect or the bug,
true,
so to speak, if we're trying to fit this case in under the dicta in the Posner opinion, occurred long before the misappropriation.
That is true. And you're correct, Justice, because Mr. Mikulski admitted at the time of his testimony that we didn't really change the product at all. We made no changes to the product.
So the damage had been done long before. The damage had been done during this period of the sales of the $600,000 worth of product during the contract period before the contract was terminated. And so you're going to have a major proof problem to try to prove that $1,900 in additional sales did your client hundreds of thousands of dollars in damage.
I acknowledge that will be an issue for the jury to consider, but it must also be recognized that once the product failure was recognized, Worldwide destroyed its product, made recall the product, and traced the product that it could so it could be replaced with proper product. So it took the efforts it could to make sure that every one of those products, to the extent it was able to do so, was removed from the marketplace. Voyager, on the other hand, not only put other product out there, but wishes to continue to do so. That, too, is a violation of the Trade Secret Act. Threatening to use the trade secrets of Worldwide is another violation.
You've got a lot of proof issues here. Plaintiff always does, right?
Sure.
Proof issue on whether you got a trade secret, you got a proof issue as to whether this was a misappropriation, you got a proof issue as to causation, which is what you were just talking about with Justice Sykes. So you just want the opportunity to prove that the $1,937 worth of products was a substantial factor in your loss.
Exactly, Justice Abrahamson. That's exactly what it is. I mean, I don't dispute the fact that there are issues here that need to be resolved. Obviously, we had a summary judgment motion on the issue of trade secret, which is attached to our brief. Additionally, there will be issues of establishing causation. And as the court has indicated, and as the appellate court has indicated, that is something that I must prove was a substantial, my client must prove was a substantial factor in producing the actual loss to our client. But what I will be able to establish to the court, or to the trial, to the jury, excuse me, will be the issue of what my client did to remedy the situation, what Voyager has failed to do and wishes to continue to do to establish this. So those are the issues that are obviously before the court here today. Is the issue of the issue before the court here today, of course, is this issue concerning damages. But there are a number of issues that must be proved to the satisfaction of the trier of fact. But that's what my client wishes to have an opportunity to do. Furthermore, obviously, there's concern about the going concern of this product in general.
Does the other side take the position that they are entitled to continue to sell this part?
Yes, yes, they do. The Voyager contends that they're entitled to continue to sell this product that incorporates worldwide trade secrets, or alleged to be worldwide trade secrets.
Is there an injunction of any kind?
No, the trial court did not grant a preliminary injunction. I believe that there were other damages at law that worldwide would be entitled to. Obviously, we're not happy with that decision, but that is the decision.
Are they still selling it now?
They indicate that they are, but I don't know how aggressively they are. I know that counsel is indicating the testimony may reflect the fact that they were maybe waiting the outcome of these proceedings to determine whether or not they will continue to manufacture the product. That very well may be in the record. But in essence, what we have here, members of the court, so we have a situation where a trade secret is alleged to have been created, several of them, by Worldwide in a very small marketplace. And they are only seeking to protect that trade secret. They were reaping quite a financial benefit from having that information secret. That benefit has been lost. It has been lost as a result of producing a product, probably unintentionally, in a defective condition. And then once the contract was terminated and most of the product recalled, continuing to market that defective product to the general public. And it is that for which we are seeking to have the opportunity to present to the jury to establish our client's actual loss as provided by the statute. Thank you.
Counsel, you have time. Let me ask this question, if I may. Your opposing counsel essentially argues that the Court of Appeals' opinion is an infringement into some of the federal legislation dealing with copyright, patent law. You've cited the Kiwani case?
The Comco case.
Comco case?
Yeah.
How does that respond, if at all, to opposing counsel? I thought there was a Kiwani case that was also cited.
There are three cases that I had indicated, the Comco case, the Sears Roebuck case, and maybe the Benito case may have been the case, Justice Bradley, that I didn't state real clearly. But those cases provide that anything that is, they all involve basically state efforts to protect items that were in the public domain that were either were not patented, or where the patent had expired. But what it includes is no doubt that the Constitution provides that we cannot prohibit the free access and copying of items that are in the public domain. But a trade secret renders its value, as indicated by the Court of Appeals in this case as well as the other cases, from being a secret, not being in the public domain. Therefore, we are not comparing apples to apples when we compare those cases. And once again, as far as the Lanham Act is concerned, we're not dealing with an issue here where there is a representation to try to sell off their product as that of Worldwide's. And we're not dealing with a commercial disparagement. They're not all trying to defame or to say something bad about our client or our product. And without reviewing it, I'm sure that that's one of the elements that they must have. That must be the intent to do that. What we have here is someone who just manufactured a product, believing there's nothing wrong with the product, having no experience in the industry, and putting that product out on the market to be used by both distributors, doctors, and the end users. That's what we have.
What is the evidence in this case that your client took reasonable efforts to maintain the secrecy of the alleged trade secret?
We We have, and we've attached to the brief as well, Justice Sykes, a copy of a manufacturing agreement. It is admittedly a poorly drafted one, but it does indicate that it would not be disclosed to anyone. Then what had happened...
I didn't say that. I didn't leave that in there.
That's in your brief in the appendix?
Is it this one-page document?
Yes.
On Worldwide Stationery?
Yes.
That's the only contract, right?
That is the only contract. When it happened, Justice...
There's no confidentiality provision in here, is there, or secrecy provision?
Well, it says here, it is agreed that Enterprise is not to manufacture or distribute ultralight components to the competitors of Worldwide Prosthetic Supply, Inc., unless it is authorized in writing by the President and CEO of Worldwide Prosthetic Supply, Inc.
Right. That doesn't say keep it secret, keep it confidential. That says don't sell to our competitors.
And I think, you know, obviously it was done by themselves, but there may be an issue of fact as well as to whether or not those reasonable efforts were taken. Were they reasonable under the circumstances? Another issue, though, Justice Sykes, is that there was proposed a more formal document that was not ultimately signed when Mikulski's decided to transfer this over to Worldwide, and that particular agreement was never signed, but yet it shows, again, it's one of the issues of fact to show reasonable efforts to maintain its secrecy.
Don't you also have to show that, some, in order to prove, as I understand, you're proceeding under 134.90 sub 2B, which is the subsection of the statute that says that one method of a misappropriation is disclosing or using a trade secret without the express or implied consent under circumstances where the defendant obtained knowledge of the trade secret under circumstances giving rise to a duty to maintain its secrecy. And if there was no such duty in the contract, why wasn't this case dismissed on summary judgment?
There's a number of different ways, if I recall correctly, and I don't have the statute right in front of me. But first of all, there, and I didn't cite to it in my brief because it didn't appear to be an issue that's here, but I know there are cases, and I'd be happy to cite to the court if the court would like me to get them, which indicates that where a party receives it in a relationship where there's going to be cooperation, that there is an implied duty of secrecy to maintain its or limit its use. Furthermore, there was also testimony as to the expectation of Mr. Curtis of Worldwide when he met with Mr. Mikulski and representations that it would remain a secret. But I'd be happy to get that information if the court would like me to do so. Thank you.
You have a proof problem on that issue.
Exactly. These are all obviously issues of fact that my client would like to have his day to present to the jury.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Robinson.
Thank you. Counsel,
as you're starting out, I would like you to assist me with your interpretation of the statute, 134.90 sub 2. I noticed in all of your comments in your first argument that you consistently used the term misappropriating or misusing, or misappropriating or using. In other words, connecting those two concepts. Yet what is connected in the statute with the word using is disclosing, as you certainly are well aware.
Well,
so walk me through your interpretation. I want to preface that with, as I understand your opposing counsel's interpretation, as you look to you look at sub 4, you get actual loss caused by a violation. What's a violation? A violation takes you to sub 2. What's a misappropriation? And their interpretation then would be a misappropriation is several things. It's A, and it can also be B, and B says disclosing or using, and they say misuse here is the manufacturing and distribution of a defective product. Okay, so how do you, what do you do with the word using? What does that mean to you?
I've been very careful to use the word using because that's what the statute says. Now, my opponent says the plain language of the statute says misusing. That's not what the statute says. The statute says using.
Okay.
Problem is you have statutes that you can say you misappropriate, but that doesn't cover using. It's kind of like stealing, you know.
Do you steal
and take away?
This is what I need to focus on. The argument is 2 defines what misappropriation is. It defines the violation. No person can misappropriate.
Right.
And what do you mean by misappropriation? Well, it can be A, or it can be B, disclosing or using. So that, under the statute, is a misappropriation. Disclosing is a misappropriation under certain circumstances, and using is a misappropriation under certain circumstances. Do you disagree with that?
No, I think that's the plain language of the statute. You use or you disclose, but what is important is the violation. It's what comes after. You have to connect this using or disclosing
using,
with the violation.
They're alleging that the defendant is using without express or complied consent, a trade secret, and we're assuming all of that for purposes of this argument that's without express or implied consent. We're assuming it's a trade secret of another.
I think the court can even assume that for the purposes of this argument that our client used a trade secret. But then the question becomes, is that the same? Do the same damages and the same evidence apply to that as opposed to this other thing that they've alleged, which is manufacturing something in a defective manner? And that's our argument, that the plain language of the statute says using. It doesn't say misusing.
Okay.
And it also says actual loss from the violation. The statute is entitled misappropriation of a trade secret. That's what it's all about. Using.
Is manufacturing and distributing a product use
it can be.
Of a trade secret?
It can be, but it can also be something else. And you have to look at what they've alleged in this case. What they've alleged is that we have damaged their reputation. We have created a confusion of sorts by manufacturing something defectively. It's not the trade secret, it's something else. We've created something else, and that's the problem with this case. You know, they have to relate misappropriation, which is what the statute is entitled. That's the violation. The violation here, that they've also alleged something else, and that's why it's a combination of several things. They've alleged a misappropriation of a trade secret. We don't have any problem with that. But they've also alleged something more, and that's what the trial court concluded. You have alleged something more than a misappropriation. You have alleged the manufacturing of a defective product. And for that, if it's actionable at all, it's not actionable under the plain language of 13490.
And that's,
there are other laws that cover that, and you haven't pled it.
And that's in part what the trial court said.
Right.
The trial court said at Appendix 122 that a trade secret misappropriation is when the secret is out, not because the secret is now being made improperly, just because it's out.
That's right.
But then if it's just getting out, what do you do with the word use?
Well, you can use a trade secret. I mean, there's several components to this case. One is that our client allegedly, and I'll concede for the purpose of this argument, you can assume that we used a trade secret, and they're entitled to damages for that. But when we do something more and create another product that's defective, then there are other laws that encompass that. Now, the court, I concede, the court could take the route the Court of Appeals took and just say damages are unlimited, simply give it to a jury and let them decide what's consequential and what's foreseeable. The problem with that is the Court of Appeals never addressed these other issues that we've talked about today, the Head Start rule, the reverse engineering law, the infringement or the preemption issues, and that's the problem. It's not that simple. This, you know, this could be a very simple case merely by saying the court should promote the public policies in the law, like Head Start, competitiveness, the contract. And by the way, to address Justice Sykes' questions, there's no... The trial court already concluded that our client did not breach this manufacturing agreement. That's why the breach of contract claim was thrown out. There is no contract regarding this. That's one of the things I'm getting at. The commercial public policy in commercial settings encourages contracts to keep things secret, to set royalty, to set all these things, the rights and obligations of the parties. Justice Kirk's talked about the economic loss doctrine. That's another example of a limitation in a commercial setting. There's limitations in the statute itself because of the words lost profits, actual damages. There's limitations in the law already with regard to Head Start, with regard to reverse engineering, with regard to all these things. There's other laws that already exist to cover these allegations, and we have to look at what they've alleged. Our clients are no longer making this. There's nothing in the record that indicates that, and our clients said it in testimony that the right thing they'd be to do would not to make to be not making this until the courts decide what's the law. This could be a very simple case by merely promoting what the courts and the law have already said are the public policies behind this statute. But to take the route the Court of Appeals took and try to make it a simple matter puts the court in very muddy waters. And from this point on, I think every plaintiff will be alleging some kind of a defect under the trade secret law to get unlimited damages unless the product is made identical to the one that was allegedly misappropriated. In other words, everybody will come in and allege these defective conditions to try to get more damages than they could have for the last 150 years.
Well, you think that you can, that a court can then, at this stage, when you're going back for a new trial, I mean, if the trial court, you had a mistrial, so you're going back for a new trial under any conditions, right? The only condition now is whether you can, what kind of damages you can show, are going to be shown against you. So you think that now is not the time to make that ultimate decision, but to wait and see how the evidence comes in and argue this by instructions or argue it at a different stage? I mean, it seems to me you're arguing now that you can't make this decision in isolation.
I think that's the problem that the trial judge had. When Judge Bischel was presented with all this evidence that she concluded confused the jury or had a potential to overly confuse the jury and just bungle things up, there were three causes of action that survived summary judgment, and yet there's an attempt throughout this trial to introduce all this evidence that she considered to be irrelevant to those three causes of action. So in the end, she granted a mistrial because she concluded that all these attempts, including, as Justice Sykes mentioned, including trying to bring in evidence that this defective product was made since 1998 and damages occurred since 1998, even though the relationship didn't end until 1999, all these things created a very... a potentially confusing situation for a jury who already was faced, like I said before, with this easily, or this inviting moral situation where you have an alleged misappropriator. So the assumption is already that this person did a bad deed. Then you have all this other evidence being introduced which aren't relevant to the causes of action that have survived summary judgment. I think that's what the trial judge faced there. And eventually she said, she said this actually all the way through. This is the evidence that has to be limited to the causes of action that survive summary judgment, and that just makes ultimate sense. In the end, there were so many attempts to try to get other evidence that weren't, including breach of contract claims and all these other things, or you know, what she said over and over weren't relevant to trade secrets claims, that she finally said, "I think this is prejudicial and." You know, tend to confuse the jury. They can't separate all this stuff out. And that's if I'm answering the question, I think she ended up concluding that, as she had all the way through, that it had to be restricted to the evidence relevant to the cause of action pled and that which survived summary judgment. And because so much stuff came in, and I think if it went back with no direction, that same thing would happen again.
Thank you, counsel. Thank you, Mr. Robinson. Thank you, Mr. Gerbers, for presenting this case to us.